Across the United States, members of the Asian American and Pacific Islander community have become the targets of racist violence from those who wrongly accuse them of being the source of COVID-19. The attacks have gotten national attention, including from celebrities like tennis player Naomi Osaka to actors like John Cho. Yet the impact of the COVID-19 virus itself on Asian American communities has gotten far less attention, especially when compared to other racial and ethnic groups. That's in part because the data on COVID-19 infections in Asian American populations tell many different stories. Some AAPI subgroups have infection rates comparable to whites, while others, like Filipino Americans, are among the hardest hit. I'm Tanzina Vega, and COVID-19's toll on the physical and mental health of Asian American and Pacific Islander communities is where we start on The Takeaway today. I'm joined by Karthik Ramakrishnan, founder and director of AAPI Data and a professor at the University of California, Riverside. Karthik, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Also is Lizelle Tanglau, multimedia journalist and project director of the TAYO Help Desk, a project of the Filipino Young Leaders Program. Lizelle, thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Lizelle, let's start with you. Why has the actual health impact of COVID-19 on Asian American and Pacific Islander communities gotten so little attention?
I think it stems from the fact that in many ways, a lot of the conversations that's been happening have taken place in a very binary form, whether it's, you know, black and white, but everything in between often never gets any attention. And I think that has had devastating impacts on a community like the Filipino American community, where we are literally on the front lines of COVID-19, but yet very little has been done on the impacts of that for our community. If you just even look at, you know, any studies or any even news coverage, very little is out there. And part of it, I think, is just this kind of just overall binary perspective, where we know that that's not true. There's just so many other threads to that.
Karthik, let's talk about what is out there. What does the data tell us right now? And we know that data about Asian American communities is often lumped together. It's not often disaggregated so that we can see how different communities that fall under that broader umbrella are being affected. But what do we know right now?
What we know is, first of all, when we look at the impacts of COVID-19, it's not only the health impacts, but also the economic impacts. And first, looking at the health impacts, what the data tell us depends on the kind of data that you're looking at. If you're looking at COVID-19 as the attributable cause of death, from the data that we see in different states that reliably collect this data, it doesn't seem like that they have a higher risk. Although those same states, they do not disaggregate the data, meaning that they do not separate the Asian population into different nationalities. So groups like Filipinos, for example, or other groups that we don't even know, right, that might have a higher risk. Chances are Southeast Asian groups that traditionally are overrepresented in the essential worker population are probably more likely to be at risk. So we can surmise that from other kinds of data like occupational data, but we don't actually have the cause of death data that is disaggregated. There's another set of data, which is the disproportionate death data. And this is something that the CDC puts out, that the Marshall Project and Associated Press did an analysis a few months ago. And using that data, so that compares the death rate at any given point in time with the prior five-year average in that state for that racial group. And you see a dramatic increase in the Asian death rate in most states across the country where they have sizable numbers. So that's something that's important to note, because that disproportionate death data could reflect the direct effects of COVID-19 as well as indirect effects, either as complicating factors or people delaying their care because they're not going to visit hospitals and clinics.
And that not going to visit hospital and clinics is because of what, Karthik?
Well, one, in general, Americans are reluctant to go visit hospitals and clinics, but there's a couple of other factors specific to the Asian American population. First is the stigmatization of the kind of rhetoric that we heard during the Trump era from the president on down. we've seen before, for example, with the onset of AIDS and the gay community, that when you stigmatize a population, they are less likely to seek care. So chances are very high that that was also going on in the Asian American community. Another factor is the Trump administration's public charge rule. This was a rule that was passed a couple of years ago, which would have made it more difficult for legal permanent residents, green card holders, to become US citizens if they got state assistance, including assistance on healthcare. So that also likely had a chilling effect. We know even before COVID that people were trying to remove their names out of health clinic records so that they would not risk their chances at naturalization. So both of those factors likely played a significant role, even more so than the baseline general population.
Lizelle, you were talking earlier about the impact that COVID-19 is having on Filipino Americans and Pacific Islanders specifically. Tell us more about that.
So the Filipino American community is getting disproportionately impacted by COVID-19. And that's just by nature of the roles we play in society. I mean, if you look at the data from the National Nurses United, you know, only 4% of U.S. nurses are Filipino, but about 30%, almost 200 registered nurses have died from COVID-19 since the start of the pandemic. And, you know, besides being, you know, represented in the medical healthcare field, Filipinos are also on the front lines in different essential roles, such as, you know, postal workers, grocery workers, and things like that. And, you know, when we work those day jobs, we come home to intergenerational households. So that also has devastated, you know, our family structure there when, you know, you're living with multi-generations, you know, from, you know, your grandparents to other family members, and you're out there working your day job, and you're at higher risk in getting exposed to COVID-19. So that has had a devastating impact in our community, along with other cultural barriers that have prevented a lot of folks in our community to seek help because it's, you know, they feel ashamed to do that, or you don't want to let people know that you're sick because you don't want to burden people for that. So that's been many of the challenges that the Filipino American community has faced during COVID-19.
Lizelle, is that also part of the sort of mental health effect that COVID-19 is having? We've been talking a lot about the physical health effects, but what about the mental health effects that this virus is having on AAPI communities?
Most definitely. I think even pre-COVID, mental health is not necessarily a conversation that comes up. It's often, you know, just tightly kept within the community because, again, you don't want to let people know there might be something wrong with you. But I think COVID has definitely kicked open the door to these conversations that, to be honest, needed to happen longer, a long time ago. And I think it's only now that we've been able to talk more openly about what is happening in our community. How do we deal with it? And how do we, you know, talk more openly and address these issues that COVID has surfaced?
Karthik, I'm wondering, we talked a little bit about why people might be hesitant to seek care. They may be afraid because of some of the racist rhetoric and violence that has been targeted at Asian Americans more recently. But I'm also wondering if there are language barriers that could emerge for folks. I live near Flushing, Queens, which is a very dense Asian American community. And there are, of course, different, you know, there are people who are here for generations. There are people who are recent arrivals. We know that this is one of the fastest growing communities in the United States. So is language and immigration status also, could that be a barrier for folks?
Absolutely. So when it comes to the Asian American population, it's important to recognize that they are the only racial group that is majority immigrant. Many people, when they think about immigrants, they think about Latinos, but Latinos are majority native born, right? So when it comes to language barriers, actually the proportion of Asian Americans that are limited English proficient is just slightly higher than the Latino population. And we can go later into the kind of dynamics of how the different proportionalities work out. Now, there are various clinics, including federally qualified health clinics, that not only provide language assistance, but also culturally competent care. So especially in places like New York, like that you mentioned, this is less of a concern because those resources are there. That said, the public charge rule did send a massive chilling effect in all of our communities, because immigrants, even if ultimately they hold some kind of a dream of going back to their home country, they are very concerned about naturalization, and the vast majority of Asian immigrants do naturalize. So saying that seeking care will penalize your ability to become a U.S. citizen, that's a very tremendous burden that people have to face. And so they're very reluctant to seek healthcare. Now, during COVID, the Trump administration did say that COVID treatment would not count against immigrant populations, but that, you know, it's unlikely that people would have found that credible given the rest of the actions that the Trump administration did. So when it comes to language assistance, in larger, denser cities, it's less of an issue. In more rural and suburban areas where you don't have as much of population concentration, language barriers absolutely are a problem. Finally, you know, when it comes beyond just actual medical care, if you look at the PPP program for small businesses and nonprofits, if you look at other kinds of programs that try to ease the economic burden of COVID, language barriers emerge significant there as well.
Vaccine equity is the population that you're working with. Are they getting access to vaccines? We've got 1 minute to go.
Sure. Vaccine equity, the data so far seems to indicate that the Asian average looks on par with the white population. But again, we know that if we dug down with many of the essential worker populations, including not only Filipinos, but Vietnamese Americans, Hmong, Pacific Islanders that are disproportionately represented in the gig economy, those populations need a lot more outreach than is currently happening.
Karthik Ramakrishnan is the founder and director of AAPI Data and a professor at the University of California, Riverside. And Lizelle Tenglau is a multimedia journalist and project director of the TAYO Help Desk, a project of the Filipino Young Leaders Program. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Decades after legendary jazz singer Billie Holiday first sang her song Strange Fruit, its legacy endures. But 21st century fans of Lady Day might not be entirely aware of just how controversial the song was when Holiday originally performed it in the late 1930s. Director Lee Daniels says he didn't learn about the troubling history surrounding Strange Fruit until he began to work on a film about Holiday's life.
It wasn't until I read Susan Laurie Parks's script, The United States versus Billie Holiday, that I realized that the government and media had suppressed information about her sort of kicking off the civil rights movement with this song of hers, Strange Fruit, which was about black men and women being lynched.
Southern trees bear strange fruit.
I think what upset me most was that I thought, how can America not know this story? And if America doesn't know this story, how many other stories are out there that we don't know?
Out this week on Hulu, The United States versus Billie Holiday depicts how federal law enforcement officials targeted Holiday for shining a light on racial injustice.
They asked her nicely to stop singing it, and then she said no. And so they realized that she was addicted to heroin, and that's how they got her. They took away her license to sing. And in that time, that's how you really made your money. So she couldn't perform any longer in New York City. They arrested her and they went to no extent. And she just continued to sing the song because she understood the importance of the song.
When I spoke with Lee Daniels about his new film, he told me that Holiday's story has unfortunately become even more relevant since he first started to bring it to the screen. And Daniels also doesn't hold back We should warn you, there's some harsh language as he describes how he deals with executives in his business that some of you might find offensive.
I was doing it because she was an unsung hero, but I didn't really connect it to the now. We did it before George Floyd. We certainly did it before the noose that was at the Capitol. I think that this movie is a call to arms. This movie is a call to arms. When I did The Butler, it was really about hope. We had so much hope with, I don't know whether you remember that last scene, Cecil Gaines is walking down to see a black president. And it was just, I cried at the end of it. I don't see my movies very often. I haven't seen any of my movies, actually, once the edit room is, I leave the edit room. But I remember leaving, going to the premiere of the film and crying. And when I left the edit room for Billy, I was crying for another reason. It just, the state of affairs that we are in and how Strange Fruit and Billy's journey is so relevant today.
You mentioned The Butler. I actually remember that moment clearly. I was at a screening for that film when it came out. And you're right, it was a very different moment then compared to today and sort of what we were dealing with when it comes to racial justice in this country. I want to pivot for a minute to your work in television. You've worked on Empire and Star. Do you have specific things that you prefer when it comes to film versus TV? Or do they give you the same type of energy? Do you have a preference for one over the other? Does the format matter to you?
I love both mediums. It's like, do you like jazz or do you like disco? Both are outlets for me to express myself and to get my work out there. I think that with television, though, I hadn't done it. I didn't know what I was doing when I walked into and did Empire. I only did it because I was told by many of my friends that television was where the money was, and I couldn't afford, though I had gotten Oscars for people and such and many awards, I could not afford to put my kids through college, and they were about to go off to school, and I was not going to take out a loan. And so I said, when my partner said, hey, let's make another movie let's make a musical, a black musical, Empire. I was like, nope, we're going to do this with television because I want some money. And but I didn't know what that meant. You know, I just thought it was like, okay, we've written and directed this beautiful story, which was the pilot. And I thought that, I thought that that was it. And then they said it was picked up. I said, well, what does that mean exactly? Well, you got to go back and you got to tell more story. I go, wait a minute, hold up. I don't know whether we signed up for all of that. And
you got to keep them hooked every week now, Lee.
I know, man. It was a really trying and hard. It was really hard for me. And also because in film, I am king. I am, no one questions anything. If you don't like anything in my film, it's me. Blame me, no one else, because I am the ultimate approval over everything. But with television, it really is it's by committee. It's your vision, but people are constantly giving you notes. The big note, I remember my partner, Danny Strong, who wrote The Butler for me, who co-wrote Empire with me, was like, Lee, I know you don't take notes, but we're walking into a group of, and he's white, by the way. He's like, walking into a group of white people, and trust me, you're going to see, it's a room full of white people. You're going to have problems. You know, just be quiet, nod and say yes. And so I did, you know, and this is the first episode. And the notes just kept coming. They were stupid notes. It didn't make any sense at all. Finally, there were literally six white people on one side of the row, and then six white people on the other side of the row, and then me and Danny at the head of the table. By the end of the hour, they were like, well, I don't understand why Cookie beats her son with a broom. Can we just take that out? I think that people won't, you know, and I lost it. I said, because that's what niggas do. We never, at the end of that, they got no more notes. It was a kumbaya, and they let me do my thing for that season, you know, so I was able to do it, but I couldn't continue on after the first season. It became, not that I don't love the characters. I just was, you know, it's not creatively fulfilling to continue to write for characters that I'd never done it before. So I jumped into another television show and had other people write. And maybe that was a mistake, because I don't think that I never responded to what was happening from the second season on. But I did often did Star, which I thought was important to the, that we talked about Black Lives Matter and trans lives and stuff that was important to me.
You mentioned not wanting to have to go through getting a loan for a project. And you've talked about the difficulty in getting, whether it's a loan or any type of funding for the films that you make. What have been some of the biggest stumbling blocks?
Actually, I don't look at them because, you know, forget the first movie I did was Monsters Ball and nobody wanted to do that either. So I remember like trying to find it, get the script and trying to get the writers and all of that stuff and really having to borrow from some illegal places to get my first movie off and up and going. Thank God that's like 100 years ago that I don't have to go to those sources. But I'm not a part of the system. I was never a part of Hollywood. I broke into Hollywood with a vision and with a specific vision that sometimes is alarming to even Black people, my own people.
Why is that, Lee? What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, a lot of people were upset with my portrayal of Halle Berry for Monsters Ball. A lot of people were, I got death threats because I had Jamal in Empire kissing a man. You know, that was never done before. And so, and I think that I'm not aware of it in the moment, but, you know, we're breaking, I'm paving the path for others too. There wouldn't be a Black Panther or Insecure, any of these shows without the juggernaut of Empire. And in that though, you are doing such iconoclastic stuff, even within the culture, that you don't realize that how offensive you are to people that don't want to see two men kissing on screen, two Black men kissing on screen, or a white woman having sex with a Black woman. And you know, all these, you know, so I can only tell the nuanced experiences of my people, of people that I know are real and people I know are in pain, and the preciouses of the world that will never, ever have a life, which is one of the reasons I was so attracted to a life to anybody else out there. And people like were offended when I did Precious, like, how can you show this Black family? Like, guess what? Because it's real. It's real and people need to, and I can't tell you how many people, how many families, how many women came up to me and cried in my arms because of Precious. But with that, for every Precious, you're gonna take a hit with people that don't want to see that and don't, and look at me as a shit starter, et cetera. And I've taken that as it is what it is. And, but I'm going to continue to do, I'm going to continue to march to my own beat.
Well, and to that point, I mean, I could see people saying, well, Lee, you know, because you have all this power, is it important to highlight, you know, pathologies in Black and brown communities rather than more uplifting stories, right? Stories that focus on other issues within Blackness, American Blackness, and the Black community.
Well, I did, I thought. I thought that I did with, I really thought I did with Billie Holiday. You know, I thought that, you know, I'm giving her a life. And here's the thing. With that life that I'm giving her, I'm honoring her as a civil rights leader. I'm also talking about her past, which people are going to be upset about. But what am I supposed to do? Lie about her past? Because that is what makes her the gem, the beauty, and the beautiful soul that she is. She can't help but being born into what she is, what she was born into. I cannot, I'm not going to lie. Everybody wasn't born into the Huxtables. You know, we are from slaves. And from that, we have, that we've survived this long and have been, that you and I are sitting here talking about it is a miracle. It's a miracle from God. And, I don't take that for granted.
We talked a little bit about Precious. So, Lee, I'm going to have to ask you, I'm sure you've been asked this many, many times, but regarding Precious, Monique, who won an Oscar for Precious, has criticized you several times. Last year, she told Fox Soul's Claudia Jordan that you and Oprah and Tyler Perry, all big names, were responsible for blacklisting her in Hollywood. Do you have any thing to say about that? Anything that your any thoughts on that issue in retrospect?
I have no comment about Monique. I have nothing but love to send to her. And no, I never blacklisted her.
You have worked in Hollywood since the 1980s, and you said you'd broken into it. But, you know, the hashtag #OscarSoWhite was only a couple of years ago. And I wonder whether you think the industry has made any lasting real change, not just symbolic change, but actual change.
Yes, I do. I mean, you have to understand, I come from back, I've been at this for a very long time. I can't believe I'm as old as I am, but I've been at this since I was 22. I'm 61 now. So I was at it when a time when it was acceptable for white people to be writing, and we were happy just to have a job. So white people were writing our stuff, white people were directing our stuff, white people were producing our stuff. And I have been a part of the evolution of making change, not just in front of the camera, but behind the cameras, making sure that Black people were employed and that gay people were employed and that trans people were employed my entire career. And that was as important to me as the stories that I am telling and that I was telling. And because it's popular now to say that this was all important, but it's a journey that I've taken. I carried myself was important to me as my stories. I don't think that, yes, has it changed? So yes, clearly it's changed from the time that I've been in here and, you know, been fighting with the studios to hire Black people. Even as far back to, you know, I remember for Empire, John Singleton was my buddy, and I wanted him to direct an episode of Empire. Well, the system wasn't set up for Black people to direct episodes of Empire or to write episodes of Empire. They don't, the unions have white people. So I had to fight for an Oscar-nominated director like John Singleton, tooth and nail, for him to direct an episode of Empire. That's where we were. That's where it was that I come from. So I see it as an enormous change. And I know some of these young kids out here now, I mean, you know, it ain't changed, you know, it is, but I've seen it and I'm really grateful for it, because I'd like to see how they could hang 30 years ago back in the trenches with me. But has it changed in a way that is groundbreaking? No, it's not going to be that way until we have studio heads, meaning the presidents, the CEOs of studios, Disney, Sony, Paramount, Netflix. Until you get Black people that are at the top of that food chain, that understand that hot sauce goes on the fried chicken and the collard greens before you eat them, you're not going to understand the nuance of the African-American experience. You can certainly hire producers that do that, but are you going to finance those films that are important? Do you really understand the culture the way you understand your culture?
And finally, we started talking about how difficult of a year this has been for so many people with the pandemic. And one of the things, Lee, that we've been doing here on the show is asking guests throughout the year whether there's something they're doing in this moment to find joy, something that brings them joy in this moment. Do you have anything that you're doing that brings you joy?
I do. I love... My boyfriend's so upset with me because I can't, but I love CNN and I love Good Morning America. It's so cool. I mean, I'm embarrassed, but you know, I wake up to it. I wake up to Good Morning America and Robert Roberts, I'm who I'm obsessed with. And I go to sleep listening to Don Lemon. It's just it's a beautiful thing to hear, to get a good grasp on what's happening in the world.
What else can I say? Lee Daniels is the director of the United States versus Billie Holiday. Lee, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
In June 2018, just a few weeks after I first got behind the mic for The Takeaway, Amy Walter joined us to host on Fridays. And ever since, our Friday show, Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway, has provided deep political analysis and hosted critical and sometimes surprising conversations about how politics shape our world. And tomorrow, Amy's fantastic run with us comes to an end. But before we say goodbye, I wanted to sit down with Amy to reflect on her remarkable show and to pick her brain about the next chapter of political coverage in America. Amy Walter is, of course, not just the host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway, but she's also the national editor for The Cook Political Report. Amy, hi.
Hi. Wow. Well, I can't believe this, right? I still remember having my first conversation with you on air. I think I was actually in Chicago for your first show. And, you know, it was about bringing all these different voices together from across the political spectrum. And here we end it at a time when we're still trying to figure out how to keep all these voices across the political spectrum in conversation rather than just in conflict, right?
Oh my goodness, that's exactly, that right there is the challenge. I mean, the conflict versus the conversation is so hard to maintain because we're so, I mean, people say this all the time, we're so deeply divided, but I really feel like we are. I mean, you're more of the expert here in terms of Beltway politics and American politics writ large. I mean, when people say stuff like that, you know, we're so divided now, we're more divided than we have been, you know, thinking back to like 2 years, 9 months ago, when you sat in the chair for Politics with Amy Walter, right, did you think we were going to end up here?
Yeah. I mean, I guess after coming off of 2016, which for many people was this realization that things were now truly going to be different and that we couldn't pretend that we could just go, you know, sort of live in a world that we had been in for so much time before that. And look, I think it shattered many of our perceptions, and rightly so. I mean, again, with every big earth-shattering event, you reveal truths that have been sitting there all along, right? You say, is this really, right? When people would say, is this really America? Are voters really thinking these things? Of course they are. They've been thinking them for a long time. Donald Trump didn't invent them, but they've been sitting there. And so I think that was sort of the goal, was to try to figure out not just, okay, are we so divided? How did this happen with Donald Trump? And instead to look at it as, where did this begin? How did we get here? And more important, to your point, are we really that divided? And I think what we've come to recognize is we aren't necessarily more divided in terms of policies. We just dislike each other more than ever. And we don't trust each other. And I was talking to somebody on Capitol Hill the other day who was saying, it just feels so weird up there now. First of all, people are walking around with masks, so you literally don't know who people are, right?
Which has been so unsettling.
Which is so unsettling, especially in Congress and for members who, at least, even if they disliked each other, they had relationships, right? Like, I know this person, I know that, okay, you're a Republican, I'm a Democrat, but we kind of know each other and we can. But now you really can't, you physically can't see each other. And there's still all this apprehension after what happened on January 6th, not just about the safety and security from the outside, but the people who were on the inside, your colleagues, that you feel like you can't trust anymore. And so that division is even more pernicious, I would argue, because when it's one thing to say we're united against whoever's out there trying to come in and attack us, right? Let's unite against that. Instead, it's, wow, the people literally in the hall across from me could have been like helping these folks or cheering for some of them, or if not actively engaging with them, or you know, promoting this, I may want to see things happen in this place that I can't believe.
And I mean, I think Americans, you know, I don't want to say all Americans, but I think there were a healthy percentage of Americans who always had a sort of skeptical view of DC right. and Congress and the presidency. But I feel like there were certain norms and certain yeah. sort of expectations that we had as a society that presidents and Congress and the Supreme Court would act a certain way mm-hmm. or do certain things. And I think that those expectations have been, at least, you know, during the time of your show, were really just upside down. I mean, yeah. I'm thinking back to the Mueller. Remember the Mueller hearings? Like, remember the Brett Kavanaugh? Remember all these things right. that happened before right. the insurrection? That just really, I think, told Americans that, you know, can they even trust in this system of government? I mean, we heard people saying, like, our democracy is on the line. Amy, did you ever think that you would hear that in your political career?
Right. That usually was hyperbolic, right? This is the most right. important election in our lifetimes. Every 2 years, that's the phrase that you hear. But it felt much more significant this time around. And it did feel as if we were really marking something significant in this election that we hadn't, certainly in my lifetime, I'll speak, and for many of other folks who've covered politics, never seeing anything like this. You know, I was thinking about this morning, Tanzina, about what is missing. And I think at its core, it comes down to this, which is leadership and standing up and doing the right thing when it's not always the popular thing. And as a parent, you can appreciate this and
yes.
will appreciate it even more. But
yes.
sometimes you have to be the adult. You have to be the parent. You can't. And that means doing the unpopular thing. And I think, unfortunately, what so many of our leaders have decided to do is they want to be the popular ones, too. Right. Let's buy the kids beer instead mm-hmm. of saying, you know, no, you can't come to my house and drink.
Right.
I know that makes me uncool, but I'm happy being the uncool parent. Because it's my job to be the uncool player. It's my job to have my kids say, I can't believe, you know, you're so terrible. All my friends are doing all these great things and you don't let me do anything. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what it means to be an adult. That's what it means to be a parent. And I think we are mistaking in many cases, you know, you do want to hear, of course, this is a democracy. The voices of everybody should be included. But at the end of the day, we have a representative democracy. We have leaders elected into these positions for a reason, because it is their job to make sense of the mess. It is their job to try to take all of these voices and competing storylines, whatever, and put some structure around it. And that has completely collapsed, because instead, what leaders have been doing is they've been sucked into the same short-term thinking that the rest of us have, right? I want to be a star today. I want to get the adoration from, you know, cable TV and the internet and all of those other things.
The viral tweets.
I want to be a viral meme, right? Mm-hmm. In a good viral meme way.
Right, exactly.
And that's a challenge. On the other hand, it's also... And I think you do this really well on your show, but is the appreciation that just because things are messy doesn't mean that it's bad, right? I mean, you and I wouldn't be allowed to host our own shows not that long ago. And by allowed, meaning that the people in charge of, right, the gatekeepers let only certain people into this process of telling the stories of America and politics. And so it's great. We have more voices than ever. We have more perspectives than ever, which, again, makes it messy. But messy isn't always bad. It's bad when no one is there to help. Just give it some structure. Not to say,
right?
You know, right? That's what, again, a good parent just puts structure in place so that that your kid knows where the boundaries are, right? And everything else can sort of grow from there. And so, look, I think we've seen some people step up as leaders. We talked about it a lot on my show of the, especially last week, those folks who are not, they're not famous people. They didn't get into politics to be, you know, this big name in sparkly lights. They were local elected officials, board of elections folks, people who were working at the polls. Like, those were some of the people who stood up and did, as you pointed out, like, they served as those guardrails that we expected, that the Republicans who stood up and said, it's not okay what's happening right now, right? You cannot have a president of the United States say these things and we just sort of brush it away. We can't do that. And they, of course, are all being punished by their own party. But those things do make you recognize that there still is enough of what is good and important about political leadership that is alive and well.
So let's turn the spotlight on ourselves a little bit and, you know, the media, if you will. The media, and I'm doing air quotes here, was the target of much political ire, particularly under the Trump administration. But some of the criticisms of the media's political coverage were also warranted. I think a lot of folks didn't quite understand what was happening early in Donald Trump's administration and sort of had to figure out and grapple with old ways of thinking to really, you know, address this really, in so many ways, we can say, unique presidency. But I wonder if you see, here we are about to start, or we've already started, under a new administration that is attempting to right the ship, if you will, on all levels in terms of decorum, presidential, you know, expectations, etc. But what about the political media? Are you excited that there is a future that this, that the political journalists have sort of taken the knocks that they needed to take, understood the criticism, and are prepared to move forward?
It's a hard question, right? I mean, this was the real impetus for the show in the first place was I had just been so frustrated by what so much of political reporting had become, you know, generating outrage rather than seeking to explain, you know, covering the loudest, most controversial voices instead of the people who are actually doing the work, focusing on so much of the politics instead of the policy. And I don't know that we've gotten any better in terms of sort of the tradition. I don't know what we're going to call it. I'm doing air quotes too. Traditional mainstream political reporting is still so focused on the personalities and on the controversies. Now, in some ways, that's inevitable because, look, that's what sells, right? Writing a 30,000 word opus on the intricacies of our healthcare law is not going to get you very far in terms of, you know, the number of clicks you need to prove to your bosses that you're worth the money that they're paying you. And so it becomes sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy. I guess what I would love to see instead is for all of the really smart, creative folks who are here in DC or in New York, if they could be employed in Sacramento or Oklahoma City or, you know, these state capitals where big things are happening, where important decisions are being made, we need more of that. And they are there, but it is still difficult to break through. And so the more that with the politics with Amy Walter, the more that you focus on these, I think it helps, you know? We got to accept the messiness. This is the beauty of our system, right? It is messy. It was designed to be messy. And to be okay with messy, it's just not okay when there's not somebody there to help at least assure you that the messiness is going to be contained in some way, shape, or form. And right now, those folks whose job it is to help guide us have really abandoned their posts.
You, however, Amy, you have not abandoned your post as far as leading us through many of these very, as you say, messy, thorny, difficult, complicated stories. So we thank you for that. We thank you for being a colleague and what we've learned from you and your work. We will never forget. Amy Walter is the host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway, which has its last show tomorrow. And she is also the national editor of the Cook Political Report. Amy, we want to have you back on as soon as we can as a guest.
Well, I want to thank, yes, and I want to thank you and the team and the show for all the support that you have given me. And we'll chat. We've got a lot of things still going on.
We have so many things happening.
Yeah.
And you'll always be a part of our Takeaway family. Thank you so much, Amy. And best
of luck.
Thanks,
Dan.
President Joe Biden's cabinet is filling up gradually. So far, 9 of the 23 positions have been filled, but the remaining nominees are not going as smoothly as the Biden administration may have hoped. Yesterday, committee votes for Neera Tanden, Biden's pick to lead the Office of Management and Budget, were delayed amid opposition from Republicans and Democratic Senator Joe Manchin. Representative Deb Haaland of New Mexico, nominee for Secretary of Interior, has faced tough questioning, especially from senators in fossil fuel dependent states. And California Attorney General Javier Becerra, Biden's nominee for Health and Human Services Secretary, is coming under fire for his stance on abortion and health care. Sungmin Kim is the White House reporter for The Washington Post, and she joins us now. How are you, Sungmin?
Good. Thanks for having me.
So let's get started. Republicans escalated their attacks against Deb Haaland during confirmation hearings this week. Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia finally said he would support her. But why was he hesitant? What was all the back and forth about Haaland?
So obviously for in Congresswoman Deb Haaland, President Biden nominated a really strong progressive to lead the Department of the Interior. As we know, this is also a groundbreaking nomination, the first Native American to hold a cabinet position. But because of her liberal views, she really did come under a lot of criticism from Republicans. You saw a lot of Republicans kind of resurface some of her old tweets that she had said about Republicans and read them back to her at our confirmation hearings. And she was always going to probably come under a more scrutinizing confirmation process than than perhaps some of the other candidates. But the reason why Senator Joe Manchin particularly, his role in this and what he eventually said yesterday was so critical was that he played a key role in, you know, potentially tanking another Obama nominee, the Neera Tanden, the director or the nominee to lead the Office of Management and Budget. And earlier this week, he indicated to reporters that he was undecided on Deb Haaland for Secretary of the Interior. A lot of that was because her hearing hadn't been held. Manchin does chair the committee that held Deb Haaland's confirmation hearing. So it does seem he was just trying to kind of keep an open mind before she had a full airing of her views and questions from senators from both sides of the aisle. But Senator Manchin did come out yesterday in full support of her. So we don't expect her to see, we don't expect, you know, any actual confirmation problems with Deb Haaland at this point.
Neera Tanden, on the other hand, is a different story.
Definitely. And we saw this happening last week when, again, Senator Manchin, and in a little bit of a surprise statement, I would say, announced that he would oppose Neera Tanden for various reasons, but, you know, pointed to some of her more sharp and intemperate tweets that she had sent, you know, in the last several years, many targeting Republican lawmakers. And that really mattered because we are divided in a 50-50 Senate. So, you know, even if you get all Democrats on board with a nominee. If you have all Republicans opposing, that means you need to bring in Vice President Kamala Harris to break the tie. So with Joe Manchin saying no, that means you needed at least one Republican to come forward and say, yes, I will vote to support Neera Tanden. But we started looking at some of the usual suspects for Republican senators who may cross the aisle and support her, such as Mitt Romney of Utah and Senator Susan Collins of Maine. They both said earlier earlier this week that that they would not vote to confirm Neera Tanden. We are all watching Senator Lisa Murkowski, a potential Republican of Alaska, but we are also watching a potential another Democratic senator who may have issues with Neera Tanden's nomination. That's Kyrsten Sinema, a Democrat from Arizona. She's been very coy about whether she would support her or not, and Democratic leaders aren't even sure where she's thinking. So for those reasons, a pair of key committee votes on Neera Tanden were pulled yesterday, which is never a good sign for a nomination.
Tom Vilsack, the Secretary of Agriculture, has already been approved. But what's interesting here, as you know, is that Bernie Sanders actually joined six Republicans in voting against him. What do we know about Bernie Sanders' decision to do that?
It was a really interesting move. I mean, obviously, we saw Secretary Vilsack serve the same role for 8 years under the Obama administration, and he sailed through his confirmation process back in January of 2009. I actually did talk to Senator Sanders directly about this after the vote, and he says, look, I have no problem with Tom. You know, I think that he will do a good job in ag, but he wanted someone who would be more aggressive in supporting family farms, the kind of farms that are in Vermont, and also be a little bit more aggressive in taking on big corporate agriculture entities. And that was kind of Senator Sanders' main objection to Vilsack as the nominee.
We know that we've got many more cabinet positions to be filled. President Trump's impeachment hearing did take up some time, but we're back on track now, right? I mean, how long do we expect the rest of this to take?
We are definitely back on track. I did a tally earlier this week before this kind of a confirmation blitz began. And at this point, Biden earlier this week, as of Monday, President Biden had, I believe, seven cabinet nominees confirmed, which was slower in pace in terms of his two immediate predecessors. You know, at this point in their presidencies, Barack Obama had a dozen cabinet officials in place. President Trump had about nine in place. But you're right. A lot of that was delayed by the impeachment trial. And it was also delayed partly because of the unusual dynamic of the 50-50 Senate, that it just took some time for committees to get organized, figure out who is chairman, how the powers were going to be divided between the two parties, and just get them up and running. But we have had a steady stream of confirmation this week. We had Linda Thomas Greenfield as the ambassador to the United Nations. Obviously, we talked about Secretary Tom Vilsack, and we're on the verge of confirming Jennifer Granholm to Secretary of Energy this week. So we're right back on track for the most part. It'll be a couple more weeks before everyone else is confirmed, but they seem to be back on pace.
Sungmin Kim is White House reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, everybody, that's it for me today. And just a note that I'm going to be taking a break from the news for a few weeks before coming back to host our new 5-day version of The Takeaway. But I'll be back soon enough, and until then, we'll have some great guest hosts taking you through all the stories you need to hear. Also, you heard my friend Amy Walter earlier in the show. Tomorrow is the last episode of Politics with Amy Walter, so please make sure you tune in. The crew has a great show lined up for you, and we wish Amy all the best. And we also say goodbye this week to our senior producer, Alexandra Botti. Alex has been with the show for more than 4 years and has led the producer team tirelessly while helping to create and edit so many of the stories you've heard over that stretch. She's a great mind and we'll miss her a lot, and we're wishing her all the best and the best of luck moving forward. Amber Hall, who's been the lead editor for Politics with Amy Walter, will now assume the role of senior producer for The Takeaway 5 days a week. And let me tell you about the other folks who make this show. Sham Sundra was our board operator this week. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. Jake Howitt is our director and sound designer. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. David Gable is our executive assistant. Our producers are Ethan Oberman, Meg Dalton, Lydia McMullen-Laird, and Patricia Jacob. Our line producers are Jackie Martin and Jose Olivares. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and I'll see you soon.